Campus FM presents a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Non-Self-Help, How Immunology is Reframing the Enlightenment. This talk is delivered by Professor David Napier, Head of the Department of Anthropology and Professor of Medical Anthropology at the University College of London.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, radio audience. Welcome back to the seminar series Work in Progress in the Social Studies. Tonight, the Work in Progress seminars is very happy to host a distinguished guest, Professor David Napier, Head of the Department of Anthropology and Professor of Medical Anthropology at University College London. Professor Napier is a key figure in contemporary American as well as British anthropology. He is one of the leading medical anthropologists in the world today. David Napier received his first graduate degree in philosophy from Louvain and his DPhil in social anthropology from Oxford. He has taught or been a fellow at Oxford, Harvard, Johns Hopkins, New York University, and now he is at University College London. He is the author of four books. The first is Masks, Transformations, and Paradox. The second is Foreign Bodies. The third, which is very well known, is The Age of Immunology. And his last book is The Writing of Passage. He has engaged in more than two decades of fieldwork with and among vulnerable and disadvantaged populations and the homeless. He has been a consultant or co-investigator on a number of projects relating to health care in developing countries. This has taken him to countries as various as Bhutan, Indonesia, Romania, Myanmar, Albania, and he's also worked at prestigious sites, institutions like the Pasteur Institute. He is a founding member of the Network for Student Activism and of Indigenous Legal Mentoring Limited. He is founding director of the University College London Center for Applied Global Citizenship. He is also the founding director of Students of Human Ecology, a registered nonprofit organization that facilitates university-level internships in the area of medicine, environment, and culture. Tonight, Professor Napier is reading a paper entitled Non-Self-Help, How Immunology is Reframing the Enlightenment. I gather that in this talk, in this paper, among other things, he is going to be discussing how new paradigms in immunology raise questions about our notions of the self and the other. Professor David Napier, welcome to University of Malta.
Thank you, Paul. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you all for coming out on this beautiful afternoon. This paper stems from more than 15 years of work on and off with bench scientists, with patients in clinical settings, and with clinicians, looking at how models of self and not self in immunology functioned at the level of doctor-patient relations, patient experiences, and also research paradigms in the bench among bench scientists. And what I'm going to do today is present the last of these, which is I'm going to try to argue that changes in scientific thinking about immunology actually have reached the point where they currently do in some very interesting and significant ways, I believe, challenge our notions of who we are as individuals. So the paper is partially historical and partially theoretical, and I hope a little bit anthropological. The first section is called Illogical Self, quote unquote. In 1960, Peter Medawar and F. McFarlane Burnett were awarded the Nobel Prize for Medicine for their groundbreaking work on immunity and the role of self and non-self in maintaining and destroying organic integrity. Medawar's ideas on acquired immunologic tolerance developed from his demonstration that mice, quote-unquote, learn to accept foreign tissue if injected with allogenic bone marrow at or before birth. That is, that one could tolerate difference until defensive intolerance was acquired. Burnett's contribution was that the body produced protective antibody cells for recognizing foreign invading antigens viewed as non-self, but in so doing failed to recognize self. That is, that one's defensive mechanism worked by not recognizing the very self it protected. By the early 1970s, the idea that there was something called an immune system was just beginning to take root in general practice, having only first appeared in the scientific literature in the mid-1960s. It's hard for us to imagine this today, that the immune system, if you go back in the scientific literature and the popular literature before the late 60s, there's no reference to an immune system, this thing that we all take for granted as being a part of who we are and how we maintain health. And why I would also, by the way, argue this recent history is so interesting and important. This change was subtle but significant, for the science of immunology moved away from an earlier reactive definition of itself that went far back into the 19th century to one now characterized by maintenance and balance. An earlier belief that dramatic, hypersensitive reactions, such as, for example, an anaphylactic shock, were the unavoidable preliminary step in the production of immunity, now gave way to the idea that immunity, once acquired, stood principally as a mechanism of defense and boundary maintenance. Immunology courses at medical schools have since then borne such titles as Identity, Microbes, and Defense. This is the Harvard Medical School's Introduction to Immunology. As one leading introductory textbook puts it, while normally acquired immunity is carefully regulated so that it is not induced against components of self, for various reasons, when this regulation is defective, an immune response against self is mounted. This type of immune response is termed autoimmunity. In many cases, exposure to foreign substances results from clinical situations in which tissue is transplanted or blood is transfused from one person to another. Rejection of the transplant or transfusion is not a manifestation of some force of nature designed to frustrate the physician and the patient. Rather, such rejection occurs because of the central tenet of acquired immunity, recognition and elimination of not self. For several decades, the work of the early pioneers of this model defined rapidly the growing field of immunology while inspiring our present understanding of transplant biology. In the absence of a fully articulated and well understood immune system, which to our surprise, as we said, now look back, first appeared in the literature only in the 60s, no one could foresee that the human self was now defended by a mechanism that could only function by not knowing or otherwise recognizing the very self it was designed to look after. Indeed, this may be immunology's first and ultimate paradox of identity, namely, how can a mechanism defend by not identifying the thing the person defended? In successive decades following Medawar and Burnett, several complex theoretical models emerged. The systemic network theory of Niels Jerny, the associative recognition theory of Melvin Cohen, and the diversified cell theories of Talmadge and Burnett, to name some important examples. Through these and others, the systemic nature of immune function became solidified, expanding the ideas of immunologic quote-unquote memory and the logarithmic rate of antibody formation, which I'll talk about in a bit, by showing how molecules could quickly replicate on binding to an injected antigen, an injected foreign entity. Through evidencing such an orchestrated defense against what was viewed as a pathogenic assault, the concept of the immune system became an acknowledged fact, even though, yet today, the very existence remains based, to quote Melvin Cohen, the Salk Institute Dean of Theoretical Immunology and head of its theoretical conceptual immunology group, quote, on experimental systems of such great complexity that many interpretations are possible and reproducibility becomes a luxury, end quote. Almost overnight, the killing and consuming concepts of pathogenic microbial invasion took root in immunology, even though at the time the nature of viruses, which I'll get to in a moment, was yet very poorly understood. Indeed, despite early optimism about the explanatory usefulness of the immune system structured to defend against invaders, the fundamental paradigm of immunology, that is, the recognition and elimination of not-self, has yet to resolve the field's major concerns of autoimmunity, transplantation, and tumor immunology. Indeed, the self-non-self model has created so many intractable problems that theorists and bench researchers alike frequently suggest that it ought to be put to rest, or replaced by a model in which antigen-presenting cells, macrophages and dendritic cells, allow the body to become aware of viral danger. This was and yet remains the contested view of Polly Matzinger, one of America's best known and most controversial immunologists. There is still, I would say, a fascinating book to be written specifically about how these models were rapidly transformed between the 1960s and the new millennium, both about how notions of what viruses were evolved out of the study of microbes, and about how immune system models related in the 1950s and 60s to the social information feedback studies of, say, for instance, the Macy Foundation, being carried out at the time by the father of cybernetics, Norbert Wiener, along with Harvard sociologist Talcott Parsons and, indeed, anthropologist Gregory Bateson. However, what is so often overlooked through these debates over models of immunity is the degree to which the immunological identity hinges on culture-bound notions of a wholly autonomous self, a concept made manifest in two basic assumptions. First, that organic integrity depends on the recognition and elimination of biological difference. There would be no immunology without recognition and elimination. And two, that the notion of a prior and persistent self is not contestable. Overall, these premises converge on a singular assumption that a self must preserve its integrity through a protective mechanism. Were a self not salient, persistent, and protectionist, that self would soon become, as Melvin Cohen himself once reminded me, a toxic dump site. Whilst the recognition and elimination model worked well for autonomous biological pathogens, such as those living bacteria and parasites, which really do attack us, none of us would contest, we now know that defending the body against a viral, quote-unquote, attack is nothing like defending it from invading organisms. Viruses need cells to achieve vitality and cannot attack without the life that an autogenous, that is, self-made cell, one made by our own body, brings to each and every viral encounter. Furthermore, because immunity demands the ongoing and ever-changing acquisition of tolerance to one's own proteins, it is often argued by contemporary immunologists who are dissatisfied with the self-non-self model that if, as we now know, the self, quote, is constantly being defined anew through defensive antibody production and related acquired immunity, isn't that another way of saying that it doesn't really exist at all? In other words, if the self is a prior and persistent Cartesian entity, then what we now know about immunity makes its focus on self both misconstrued and inappropriate. Either immunology is not about the self, or if it is about selfhood, then that self is not Cartesian. The second section of this paper is called A Basic Conundrum. If so much in immunology depends on what a self is, can what we have learned from immunology to reverse our terms make possible a rethinking of our time-honored concept of selfhood? Does immunology, to reverse our inquiry, tell us something new regarding our cultural and historical assumptions about identity and what it is that makes for a self? While good bench science depends upon building on existing assumptions, anthropologists can look towards other cultures for models of self and other, for there are many examples, Hinduism being one famous one, in which body image boundary is defined by a careful familiarity with and a regulation of new stimuli that may, in turn, be helpful or harmful. Without providing an extensive inventory of possible models that a full historical an anthropological assessment of these questions would require, something, by the way, very much in need of being done, we may and should ask what might be gained by such an inquiry. Are other notions of self applicable in any way to theoretical immunology? To answer this, we need briefly to revisit the famous question of whether viruses are living things. For we will see that the virus stands somewhere at the borders of self and non-self, and is thus as much a conditioner and definer of a body's boundaries as it is a single-minded attacker. A comparison of an excellent contemporary introduction to cellular biology and any of the early popular attempts at explaining whether viruses are living things reveals that our assumptions about the vitality of viruses has changed little over the past 40 years. For despite the fact that the virus does not have mobility, we continue to describe them as if they do. Indeed, today's text puts the question aside as intractable. And here we have a quote from a well-known textbook in introductory biology that's been published repeatedly, The World of the Cell. And it describes this in the following way. The question is sometimes asked whether or not viruses are living. The answer depends crucially on what we mean by living. And it is probably worth pondering only to the extent that it helps us more fully understand what viruses are and what they are not. The most fundamental properties of living things are mobility, irritability, perception of and response to environmental stimuli, and the ability to reproduce. Viruses clearly do not satisfy the first two criteria. Outside their host cells, viruses are inert and inactive. They can, in fact, be isolated and crystallized, almost like a chemical compound. It is only in an appropriate host cell that a virus becomes functional, undergoing a cycle of synthesis and assembly that gives rise to more viruses. And because it is intractable, we continue to use volitional, intentional metaphors that encourage us to think of the virus as a living thing that can commandeer a healthy cell, reduce it to a nursery, and reproduce itself at breakneck speed. But how can a virus do such things if it is inert and without locomotion? How can viruses recognize, scout, trick, discover, alert, evade, sense, recruit, mobilize, prod, mask, defend, scavenge, attack, invade, adapt, appropriate, sacrifice, and kill? These are all words, by the way, taken from biology textbooks. If they lack mobility and do not respond to environmental stimuli. If these are mere linguistic conventions, why should we continue to employ them when they are so inaccurate? Here is a common example of the consequences of such conceptualizing, one, by the way, made famous by Susan Sontag in her 1990 AIDS and Its Metaphors. It will resonate easily with what most of us have been told. Excuse me while I turn to the screen. The invader is tiny, about 1/16,000th the size of the head of a pin. Scouts of the body's immune system, large cells called macrophages, sense the presence of the diminutive foreigner and promptly alert the immune system. It begins to mobilize an array of cells that, among other things, produce antibodies to deal with the threat. Single-mindedly, the AIDS virus ignores many of the blood cells in its path, evades the rapidly advancing defenders, and homes in on the master coordinator of the immune system, a helper T cell. On the surface of that cell, it finds a receptor into which one of its envelope proteins fits perfectly, like a key into a lock. Docking with the cell, the virus penetrates the cell membrane and is stripped of its protective shell in the process. The naked AIDS virus converts its RNA into DNA, the master molecule of life. The molecule then penetrates the cell nucleus, inserts itself into a chromosome, and takes over parts of the cellular machinery, directing it to produce more AIDS viruses. Eventually, overcome by its alien product, the cell swells and dies, releasing a flood of new viruses to attack other cells. But if, on its own, a virus remains inert and without locomotion, why should we privilege it with agency? Why should we, in fact, refer to viruses as foreign agents at all, if a virus is lifeless outside a living cell? And if the floating virus is not an active other to be defeated, what generates a so-called viral attack? Why, furthermore, should the body's bringing it to life be understood as primarily a defensive activity if a virus on its own is inanimate? Finally, if the so-called defensive antibodies we create and those proteins essential for identifying foreign bacteria and viruses are de facto not coded for marking self, how can we see them at all as self or as a defensive mechanism of self? Might it be that our persistent characterization of viruses as active agents arises partly from the cultural belief that harboring otherness within us is principally dangerous? a belief whereby a persistent self must in turn always be protected against things foreign. Though we all have cancer cells within our bodies, for example, we never say we have cancer until those cells become problematic. In fact, this ambivalence about and concern over things foreign within us is why, until the arrival of stem cell research, studying the maternal fetal was so often unsatisfying for immunologists. To put things in perspective, in an era of research now dominated by attention to uncommitted embryonic stem cells, it's worth listening to a well-known Australian immunologist's view of the maternal fetal only a few decades ago. In 1975-76, the Nuffield Foundation had supported the distinguished Australian immunologist Graham Mitchell in what was hoped to be new groundbreaking work in this area. But this kind of immunology was unsatisfying for most immunologists whose training emerged from the understanding of the invasive agents of bacteriology and parasitology. As Mitchell put it, commenting on this period of his own research in the 1970s, quote, "The maternal fetal was a good thing, but we just didn't have the techniques, just didn't have the way of approaching the question. It's something which a lot of people have actually got into for a short time and then got out of, the immunological aspect of nature's most successful foreign graft," in other words, pregnancy, "how the fetus actually survives inside the immunologically hostile mother. We know she is responding to antigens from the fetus, so we did a little bit on that and then got a couple of publications. But that was a bad year. We had the idea and we thought, wouldn't it be nice to have got some money for it? And then we were under pressure to deliver on the money we got from the Nuffield Foundation. We weren't into the field enough, and I must say, we really didn't get into the field because I got absolutely seduced by host-parasite relationships." As a group of social scientists then studying Mitchell's work pointed out, it is clear that Mitchell's own background, experience, and context fitted him better for research into the immunology of host-parasite relationships. He had no special background in reproductive physiology. In fact, most immunologists didn't prior to the era of stem cell research, and was unfamiliar with key techniques needed in the maternal-fetal studies. As he, Mitchell, himself put it, quote, "We were not particularly good at tissue culture, but he was au fait with the basics of parasitology. Quote, I didn't, Mitchell claimed, have the hang-up, which a lot of students do have, of learning the list of 50 parasites and remembering the life cycles and remembering what host they parasitize and so on. That was behind me as an undergraduate, a little bit of boning up, and that's all I needed for that." But Mitchell was far from alone at that time in being unsettled by the area of embryonic cell research that now dominates the news. Embryology had, since the war, faded in importance, in fact, as microbiology grew dramatically, leaving immunology and virology to evolve alongside and out of the studies of invasive agents and infectious diseases. Why do autoimmune symptoms often subside in pregnancy? Why do women have much higher rates of autoimmune infection, as much as 7 or 8 times than men? Might even childbirth itself, as immunologists often think, be understood in terms of immunological rejection? These are today's questions more than yesterday's. But given them, perhaps precisely because of them, we should, I would argue, persist in revisiting our earlier question. How can viral antigens be considered foreign invaders if our own cells animate viruses? In Darwinian evolution, there is no reason for a healthy organism to seek out something that might harm itself, except when, in retrospect, we call that encounter conditioning. And because organisms do not spontaneously endanger themselves in a naturally selective world, viruses must, at some level, it is assumed, be aggressive killers, even if they are actually inert until brought to life by a cell. There is, however, I would argue, another possible view, namely that antibodies are a key to exploring the dividing line between self and other, a mechanism by which one's identity as a living thing becomes contested and eventually defined. Identity, in this sense, remains, to the considerable relief of immunologists, a prior and persistent condition, but one that is now defined at the peripheries of selfhood where it is contested and challenged. If we can accept such a view of identity, one widely evidenced in the anthropological literature, I would argue, there is only one logically consistent and satisfying conclusion to be drawn. Namely, if viruses need cells to come alive, the so-called immune self, our antibodies, must attract or otherwise absorb those potentially pathological viral antigens. We know, that is, who we are by the risky, dynamic, and sometimes painful process of discovering what we can and cannot accommodate. If you can't stand the heat, as Richard Nixon was so fond of repeating ad nauseum, get out of the kitchen. Survival in this view being predicated on stepping forward, taking the heat, and doing something with it besides caving in. Although a completely different paradigm, the notion that antibodies absorb potentially harmful bits of inert matter to transform, for better or worse, their packaging of information actually makes good sense and withstands all logical trials we might set against immunology's major conundrums. For an antibody is a tool that enables a living thing to explore the boundaries of life, to engage that danger which is the precondition of real change, whether that change be life-giving or life-taking. Though many may find the concept of inviting danger intolerable, in some non-Western notions of selfhood it is considered both logical and coherent. There are multiple anthropological examples of how self is made up and defined by potentially dangerous encounters at one's boundaries. The third and final section of this presentation is called Non-Self-Help, Compatibility Reconsidered. Now, I've suggested how an alternative view of viral activation, one arising from within contemporary immunology, by the way, can reframe immunology's former paradox of identity. But what of its other more vexing paradoxes? Can this assimilative view of viral life also reframe them? Let us briefly apply such an interpretation to two other outstanding and famous paradoxes of theoretical immunology. The first is the evolutionary paradox. And this paradox goes something like this. How can the human body continue to create a broad specificity repertoire, a wide range of B bone marrow and T thymus cells, when natural selection would otherwise demand that apparently superfluous deformations be eliminated? The answer is that in an anthropologically and historically informed model, natural selection is no longer a problem because the body is actually creating possible versions of otherness rather than mutations of self. The bone marrow, B cells, and thymus, T cells, explore otherness rather than defend selfhood. And you can see here in this diagram, just for those of you, the yellow, obviously, or green indicating the bone marrow, and then the human lymphoid organs where immunity is expressed are also represented on this diagram, just as a reminder. For the human body appears to produce an extraordinary number of antigen-inducing antibodies, some threatening and some harmless. Indeed, estimates of the human antibody repertoire, that is the number of antibodies potentially created, runs from 10 to the 5th power to 10 to the 16th. And if these figures weren't already mind-boggling, because most antigens have many epitopes, in other words, amino acids or sugar residues that are antigenic outside determinants, response cells in the lymph node, and because I'm going to start with the quotes and get the whole thing. Because most antigens have many epitopes, and a given epitope can be recognized by more than one lymphocyte, the number of lymphocytes that can respond to a given antigen is much higher than the number of cells possessing a certain antigen receptor. So actually, the point to be made here is when you actually get to the lymphoid organs and the number of manifestations that can be expressed, we're not just talking about somewhere between 10 to the 5th and 10 to the 16th. We're talking exponentially about several times that order in terms of numbers of diversity of diversified cells that the repertoire can be responsible for. According to natural selection, these numbers should be naturally limited. Superfluous creations should be eliminated. Bodies don't, for instance, spontaneously generate organic variation in anticipation of unanticipated events. In evolution, the body responds and adjusts to stimuli. It does not create spontaneous mutants, or at least does not do so as a function of a health-enhancing activity. As, however, cellular diversity by definition proliferates in immunology, this so-called immunological repertoire appears paradoxical to immunologists when it creates mutants that have no apparent target, or at least it did so up until recently. A body should not produce spontaneous experimental deformities in anticipation of a singular cellular mutation out of millions upon millions that might be useful for some future unknown threat. Furthermore, for binding to take place, an antibody must be created with a locking mechanism that works for an unknown antigen. This makes no sense either because variation by definition is infinite, unless immunologists, as some evolutionary biologists have, come to accept the possibility that antigens develop from the nucleic acids of normal cell genes, in other words, out of the attenuated nucleic structures, the acids of, as it were, former cells, or at least something very much like them. In other words, in this model, this evolutionary model, antigens become or something more like former self because they can be they express locking mechanisms that combine rather than true other or non-self. If this is the case, what of antibodies, those mutations we generate in anticipation? Might they not be seen then as creative attempts to engage risk at the borders of self? In numerous non-Western models, identity depends upon just such a dynamic engagement. However, I'll refrain from making the complex digressions that such an explication would necessitate, but refer to the many examples of spiritual engagement, for example, ritual warfare, and marital customs described in the anthropological literature, wherein the assimilation, the, as it were, vaccination of otherness proliferate. Indeed, the anthropological literature is replete with examples not only of how body image boundaries may become transformed or otherwise malleable, but where they position themselves to assimilate other selves or, as it were, evolutionary former selves as a means of establishing and negotiating identity and body boundaries. If natural selection is the parent of traditional immunological identity, cell biology shows that there is nothing natural at all about selection, at least as it relates to the benefits and drawbacks of encountering danger. For a self understood as a prior and persistent identity can never ascertain in advance whether a selective pressure is ultimately destructive or constructive. Right? We can never know in advance whether this conditioning danger is constructive or destructive, which is also incidentally why natural selection is frequently accused of being teleological. Therefore, such a self can only constantly attempt to eliminate difference. The result of this elimination may reflect the immunology we have inherited, but it will not answer the contradictions of the field now being taken on by contemporary immunology, contradictions whose resolutions, I would argue, shake the very foundation of our thinking about what makes a self prior, persistent, and autonomous. So much today, at least, for the evolutionary paradox in immunology. But there is another equally famous outstanding paradox that an assimilative view of viral encounters resolves. This is what is known as the repertoire paradox. And it goes something like this. How can we argue that the proliferation of B cells and T cells is adaptive when neither the size of the immunological repertoire nor even the presence or absence of the thymus itself, our major generator of immunity, can be construed of as an indicator of resistance? Some organisms do very well indeed with quite a limited repertoire, and it is widely accepted that repertoire scope is only relevant to the number of potentially pathogenic viruses that can influence an organism. One may not need a thymus at all if there is no danger, no alienated variation of identity, no similar other or, as it were, former self being expressed. Furthermore, foreign viruses in prokaryotes, those organisms whose DNA is not contained inside a cellular nucleus, are not always harmful. This is an important point that we often forget. Some are innocuous, others are real mutation transformation factories without a clearly defined target, undermining the very notion that the body seeks always to rid itself of difference. But identifying non-self need not only be defensive in this new immunologically and anthropologically informed model of self. For immunity can now be understood more as a creative attempt to engage difference than solely as a battle to eliminate it. Here, immunity is less a system of protection and defense than a system of information assessment, even of creation. For we survive through risking engagement with difference, as so many new students of mirror neurons, for instance, are eager to tell us. Today, then, immunology sees itself quite differently, and I would argue is well positioned, perhaps better positioned than any other domain of modern science, to help us rethink notions of the self that have dominated Western philosophy at least since the Enlightenment. Compare the recognition and elimination model of immunity, for instance, with a recent Salk Institute discovery that certain skin cells with a hereditary blood disease called Fanconi anemia could be re-engineered to revert to stem cells, which could then be recommitted by use of a virus. Okay. What this means is that the repaired cells, constructed by reverse engineering to a naive stem cell, and then, as it were, reinfecting it, can now be used to replace the defective bone marrow cells characteristic of a disease that also results in very low blood cell counts. A cure becomes possible because rather than suppressing immune responses, we reshape them by encouraging and feeding new viral information, information of a new type that one day may well lead to new therapies for what were once incurable genetic disorders. And I would guess that these Salk Institute researchers are probably in line for a Nobel Prize as a result of this. We'll have to see. What made this possible, I would argue, is an unrecognized but giant leap that has almost subconsciously become a core immunological precept, namely that viruses don't invade us, but that we, for better or worse, bring life to the sometimes dangerous encounters that define the limits of who we are, that limit what we can be, and that hopefully do so without taking the very life that those viruses, once embodied, now inform, or as we used to say, infect. Burnett's antibodies, which recognize foreignness, non-self, but fail to recognize self, are now replaced by antibodies that function as self-search engines, search engines of the information, harmful or helpful, that sits latently in viruses like books in a library. If, as evolutionary biologists now widely suppose, pathogens evolve from normal cell genes or entities much like normal cell genes, for how else could they bind to receptors, what our antibodies must be recognizing are as much aspects of selfhood as aspects of foreignness. The difference made possible by this view is neither subtle nor semantic, for it shows us that cellular antibodies risk bringing life to alien viruses in order to revitalize these biologically binding and therefore related, even if dangerous, forms of self in order to adjust and respond to them. In this view, the self stands not only as something prior and persistent, but also as a living thing capable of constantly recreating and reclaiming its identity through ameliorating encounters. Know your friends well, your enemies better. Thus understood, the body interacts with its environment in an attempt to create a new future. Burnett, who said it could be no other way than for antibodies to fail in recognizing self, did not suspect that there was another way of resolving immunology's paradoxes, a way that might change how we view the self and its environment. Part of this was because of immunology's evolving out of cell biology and parasitology, where real organisms do attack one another. Part of this was because we needed molecular genetics and stem cell research to demonstrate the actual protective potential of virally modifying and loading cells over trying to kill them off. The alternative view outlined here, although not the last word on the immunological self, does provide, I think, an explanation by which immunology's paradoxes can be reconciled with what is known. If proven correct, it may or may not help reshape scientific research, as it, however, seems now at the threshold of doing. But it will certainly force us to reconsider immunology's contribution to the metaphysics of human identity. Thank you.
Great, thanks.
Thank you very much, David. For tonight's paper. Before I think we get down to asking questions about or discussing the content of the notion of self, which you seem to show is changing with the change in immunological science. I think one question the audience might like to engage you on is this. When you probe new developments in immunology and biology, and you look at cell life or viral life, are all of these various bodies and mechanisms which you talk about, do you see these as simply as metaphors for the human self and the social self? Or, I think some of us would like to ask you, do you think there is an underlying equation or identity between these various antibodies, antigens, and their various processes, conflicts, and absorptions on the one hand, and the human being on the other? That's more of a logical or philosophical question I'd like to ask to begin with. Are you talking metaphorically about social and human cells, or do you see a very, very real and direct, how to put it, link between life at the cellular and subcellular level on the one hand, and life at the human social level on the other?
Well, I think that's an excellent question, and I think it's a question that Aristotle asked a long time ago, which is, Aristotle asks if what makes the world one will also be what makes a man, if you'll pardon the gender bias language. The idea being that there was some specific continuity between our understanding of who we are, quite physically, as human beings, and how we understand how the world is organized. But to get to the question of metaphor, I think if I could respond to that, Paul, I'd want to say this: that I think what really interested me in doing this research was seeing how, for a very long period of time, there was great resistance in science actually to accepting how metaphorical its descriptions actually were. So the haunting question here is, would we have hit upon stem cell research a very long time ago had we not been thinking about viruses as invading agents? And I would say absolutely. Because if you look at how embryology as a science fell into great decline as cell biology rose, and you look at how immunology grew out of infectious diseases and parasitology specifically, you see how the metaphorical conceptualization of self and non-self really was put blinders on. You heard an immunologist saying, we just didn't have the tools to think about how we actually went about this. And Melvin Cohen said to me at a seminar at the Pasteur Institute, he said, well, if I take your view of this is now 10 years ago, by the way, I think a lot of this has changed. What I'm trying to show here is the positive side, which is that immunology actually embracing its own discoveries, as it were, quite in a much more coherent way. But he said, well, if I take your point of view, I'd have to give up what I do. If I don't think of the self as prior and persistent, and I don't think of the immune system as a recognition and defensive mechanism, then I have nothing to do at the bench. In a way, I think both of those questions are appropriate in this context, and that what I see interesting historically is the science really at the threshold of asking some very profound questions about the way in which the self is defined by its encounters with otherness. I made the allusion to the mirror neurons. I mean, the studies of Ramachandran and others about, I know that that's contested as well, but at the same time, it's very interesting how bench scientists are really taking on what we would take to be social questions about identity and seeing how the methodology of scientific research programs are actually culturally articulated at a certain level, and that finding other models that allow one to reframe that could be, and indeed is turning out to be, a very healthy thing for the field.
That's very interesting. You're taking some of the mystique out of the separateness of scientific language, scientific discovery, scientific theorizing. You've kind of turned my question on its head. And if I was asking you how, in fact, philosophers or social scientists use biology as a metaphor, you're actually saying that it's been a constant practice of biologists and physical scientists to use human activity and society as a metaphor. And I think that's very interesting. But I hope that gave some people a pause to think of a question they would like to ask. One thing I would like to put forward here, or push forward, is your discussion of this new notion of the self as assimilative, absorptive, as opposed to the self as trying to separate out and defend itself against the other. I mean, that obviously has many resonances and many possible implications. So I guess the question I'll throw at you goes something like this. Is this really new? Well, the question would be like this. Hasn't it been true for a long time in social theory that the self has always been defined by the other? In other words, I'm trying to stake out here, I'm trying to figure out here what you're trying to claim as being quite new, quite interestingly, intriguingly new here. I mean, I'm thinking, for example, of Frederick Barth, Ethnic Groups and Boundaries, 1969, when in fact my take on Frederick Barth's whole approach to identity is that identity is not even conceivable without an other, that it's conceptually and logically impossible to begin to talk about self without talking about the other. And if that's what was at stake in Barth's approach to identity, then it seems to me that where are you trying to show a difference?
It's actually a totally appropriate question. We were talking about ethnic groups and boundaries this afternoon, and of course Barth's position is that he describes culture as an empty vessel, something that's defined at its peripheries where it's contested and challenged. But we would add to that, of course, what we recognize as the anthropological paradox, which is, on the one hand, we say it takes one to know one. You have to be of a particular ethnicity, or you have to be of a particular gender, or of a particular culture to represent that point of view. But on the other end of the spectrum, we take Barth's view, which is that the hardest thing to know is your own culture, because at the center it's opaque and embodied and in some ways even covertly understood. That is to say that we are what all people are, and we define ourselves against that other at our boundaries, where we understand what the limits of that category of selfhood are. And I think that that's a very appropriate question in this context. Again, I think what's interesting about watching immunology over time is the extent to which, I mean, those words that I read out, those volitional language that I read out, those actually come from textbooks, yes. Contemporary textbooks in cellular biology. And why in the face of this would those textbooks say, well, the question of whether viruses are living will remain unanswerable, but everybody knows they're not living. The problem is that it creates all these other questions about invasive agency, which we're going to go down. We've got to hold on to this so tightly that we're willing to sacrifice actually examining the actual nature of what viruses are in order to hold on to this other ideology. And for a long time, this actually persisted within immunology. Yet, because it could not answer those questions, and because of some of the discoveries which suggested the total wrongheadedness of that point of view, they're now taking a really radically different position here, which is much more like, I would argue, is common in say forms of Hinduism and animism, where you have a permeable body image boundary where negotiation of borders is a function of acknowledging that self and other are always being mediated at some level, and that the self is not this autonomous prior and persistent thing that stems all the way back to Judeo-Christian ideology about autonomous selves and the salvation of the self, and finds its secular manifestation starting in the Enlightenment, where you get scientific agnosticism suddenly taking that notion of autonomy but actually viewing it in a in a way that's not predicated upon divine intervention.
So there's a huge continuity between Christian emphases on the self and post-Christian secular emphases on human autonomy.
Absolutely.
As the basis from which we think about the world around
Absolutely.
Us.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Sir.
Hello, where do you see this going? This whole sort of, your explanation of metaphors and how they inform science and how they've shaped our thinking and research. And now that sort of we know about it and things have been changing. Where do you see it going? Because you've been working on this project for a number of years. Have you seen any changes, or have, the scientists you spoke to, have they been enlightened in any other way?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious that there's a political argument here that has to do with resistance towards accommodating difference, and that immunology as a science evolves out of the need for defending borders in ways that are really quite. I mean, to look at this metaphorically again, not to stretch the. It's very interesting because if you look at autoimmune studies historically, as Silverstein has done in his book on the history of immunology, Silverstein shows that there's a period of dark ages of autoimmunity, and what he means by that is a period of time during which studies of autoimmunity desist almost completely, from the first major discoveries to the time when it's picked up again. There's this period, and that period corresponds exactly to the period of the first and second Great Wars, which is to say that when there are real foreigners at our borders, the attention to this, Nietzsche says, in times of peace, the warlike man attacks himself. Okay. And actually, a concern with that, an interest in autoimmunity, is almost excluded historically from the period between the two great wars. So I think that the political agenda here is one of asking, looking at this recent history and asking what are the things that allowed us not to look at this more directly when it was very clear that these paradoxes that I mentioned are well known. They're described and articulated in the literature. They're talked about at theoretical immunology symposia as if they're not resolvable. But there are resolutions. And I started talking about this kind of a resolution, anthropologically informed resolution, in the mid-80s, and I was with immunologists, and the response was largely, well, okay, that's interesting, but it doesn't do me any good right now to think about it that way. Let's get back to work, right? However, today, this sort of model, I wouldn't claim myself because it's coming in a more articulated way from the field itself, which I think is really encouraging. Now, the question in terms of where it goes from here is how this actually spins out in terms of awareness of how much the self needs to engage difference in order to be aware of the extent to which its version of its identity is limited by those cultural factors.
Of course, another point here with regard to your previous answer is that to a certain extent you are redefining life itself. I mean, there's the self-non-self distinction, but in a sense, there's also the distinction between living, non-living. And in a sense, it seems to me that if you're talking about cells or other living bodies that exist and develop by appropriating or assimilating or welcoming outside influences and outside threats, who, as it were, generate or build up a risk potential, then to a certain extent you're redefining the difference between living and non-living. Mm-hmm. You're talking about a flow. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you bring up the issue of flow, then I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you my question from Deleuze and Guattari's Thousand Islands, which I found a very impenetrable book. But on the other, he seems to, as I think I said at a former seminar, what Deleuze and Guattari seem to be trying to do is they seem to be trying to write the human self and the human human individual out of their text. I mean, the one thing I can get out of that book with all of its many chapters and its circulatory movements is that they seem to be trying to rewrite language in such a way that you don't need individuals. So it becomes an intriguing philosophical point where you no longer define the group or the mass in terms of the individual or a collection of individuals, mm-hmm. but rather you look in terms of the mass. And then from then they go on to start talking about flows or movements as opposed to definable individuals. And I can't help feeling there's a certain analogy or vague resemblance between their interest in moving away from a language of the individual to a language of masses and flows and processes, to your interest in looking at the way, in fact, the self needs to be rethought in terms of its absorption of the other or its opening to the other.
Well, I think here where I would dispute a thousand plateaus is I think that that I mean my former supervisor Rodney Neame used to say, you know, why do philosophers go on talking about, you know, were a Martian to come down here and how would they view our local habits? All you have to do is go to another culture, and you can find, you know, as many versions of self and non-self finally articulated over millennia within given societies, enough to keep your mind spinning for, you know, more than a thousand plateaus, if you know, to extend the connection to Deleuze and Guattari. But I think that the difference here, why I find it so interesting to look at immunology, is people do die from viruses. I mean, real people, you know, this is, the disease is actually, it's not a philosophical question of relationship of self to non-self. And no one would argue based upon this that viruses are good things, but in illness experience, we focus on the ones that actually, those information packages that carry fairly lethal, you know, these are the Trojan horses, right, of self-non-self encounter. But they're only a fraction of all the versions of, you know, as I said, we've got these transformation mutation factories that work within our bodies all the time, and some of them are inert, some of them are pathological, some of them are beneficial, potentially. Some condition us. Every vaccine we get is presumably a conditioner that enhances our ability to understand our environment. So I think where I would agree with them, and I would agree with some of the more radical biological theorists like Lynn Margulis and symbiotic, you know, gnosis of symbiosis between self and environment, that it is really quite important to consider the ways in which boundary maintenance is a matter of knowledge, and that viruses are information packages that we actually process. And the model I like to use here is not necessarily Frederick Barth's empty vessel, but it's more. And again, I think there's a little political message here of the avant-garde. You know, the notion of the advance guard, which actually isn't an artistic term but a military term. That is to say that we need to go out to the borders and assess what the potential danger is. And it does us no good to fall prey to that, because there's no information that we can then assimilate and somehow. So it's more like a rite of passage. That is to say that, you know, that there is a challenge that within certain limits helps us to define who we are, and that information needs to be reprocessed within a self that does to a certain extent have a prior and persistent character. And I think this is why immunologists are relieved, because we are talking about the fact that you know, within 80 years none of us will be here, right? And within 30 years some of us won't. I mean, that is to say that we're talking about our individual mortality as it relates to what we contribute to that collective. So I would dispute the idea of eliminating selfhood from the discourse of flows of the flows of life, as it, you know, to use another well-known trope. But I would say that, and this is why I brought up the anthropological paradox, that in some ways anthropology has to mediate between notions of self that are prior and persistent as manifested in some cultures, and notions of self which are highly malleable and transformative that are manifested in other settings. And I think this is why it's interesting, both as an anthropologist, to be looking at what immunologists are doing, and also interesting for immunologists to think about these other models, because they do affect research paradigms in significant ways, which I hope I've alluded to.
Mary.
I don't know much biology, so I'm a bit of, I find it surprising that immunology hasn't already contested its own field earlier, you know, given, for example, in anthropology and philosophy, the idea of a unitary self has long been contested in psychology and in other fields. That's the first. Secondly, it seems given using words like stem cell, is in itself stem or still keeping the prior and persistent, and should that be seen as oppositional to malleable, we can be prior and persistently malleable, which in a way you were saying that. And also, how is it that the immunologists didn't think of this earlier, given there are many people who have autoimmune diseases and are both self and other in themselves? I mean, I, for example, have three autoimmune conditions. So which self am I? Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, and how, and do you become your illness, of course?
No, exactly. Yeah. You know, yeah. And people like that have had these autoimmune conditions. You know, we've known about diabetes, for example, or thyroid conditions, or ME, whatever, for a long time we've had data. So haven't they been thinking about this earlier?
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I think that there is definitely, as I think I mentioned just in one sentence passing here, I think that there is a wonderful book to be written here that needs to be written about the recent history of this field, because there are so many other things going on here that we didn't talk about that we could have critiqued. One is, it would be to build upon the way in which, I mean, you know, immunology in the 50s was allergy. It was sort of the backwaters of medicine. It was, you know, it was not funded the way infectious diseases were. And indeed, you could look at this from the standpoint of the economics of scientific research funding and show how we deal with cancer with nitrogen mustard. I mean, we were actually killing off cells. You know, you almost kill a person and hopefully they survive the chemotherapy and can evolve out of that. I mean, there's very much a case to be argued that the reason that we pushed aside what we really recognized or were concerned about philosophically about viruses was because it didn't fit the paradigm of infectious diseases. And let's face it, immunology, you know, that went from being the backwaters to dominating all the funding. And if you add on to that the whole audit culture that we all live within which, you know, your next 5 or 10 year program, you have to know your results already in order to get funded. I'm not being cynical about this. I mean, we all know that you don't get refunded by blue sky research. You know, you get funded by having a hypothesis you're pretty sure you can demonstrate. You're going to find, you know, at the bottom of every scientific article, you know, read Nature or, you know, read any of the popular scientific magazines. Everybody claims that this is going to be a cure for something. You know, this is, in other words, this isn't just an ideological topic that we're considering. If we don't have something that this is going to cure, our funding is going to be cut. And so I think that, you know, there's a combination of factors that lead to us sort of turning a blind eye to what seem like just theoretical considerations until we got to the point where actually could see that there was a lot to be gained, not just in terms of controlling illnesses, but also in terms of funding through looking at embryonic stem cells and understanding that these not quote unquote naive cells, you know, were committed. I think you could argue that Medawar and Burnett were actually, what they got their Nobel Prize for was a very clever way of showing how infection could be grafted onto something that was relatively unknown, and it was a pretty good explanatory model from the standpoint of not really understanding what viruses were or how they behaved, and your question about immunity. That's where I began too, was talking to people about, you know, what does it mean to walk into a clinician's office and be told that your body's at war with itself in terms of identity?
I think the economic point you mentioned, for me, is, I was going to ask if I had time, but now I do. There's something you didn't mention, the ethics of this work. Because obviously by saying that the self is, we can think differently about the self and what attacks and what doesn't, and we can also begin to talk about organ transplant between species, tissue consumption, and big business. And, you know, so, I mean, I can see the historical and the economic will explain why we're now moving in that way.
Yeah. I mean, I'm putting a better face onto something that could be examined quite critically, for sure.
One other general implication, I think, which follows from the kind of assimilative approach to the other, rather than a resistant approach to the other, which you're advocating, is that if these redefinitions of life, of the body, of the self, are going on in immunology and are being picked up by anthropologists like yourself, given the discussion we've had here, one is inclined to think that the emphasis on the risk society and that whole theoretical trajectory in sociology and anthropology might also be less tense. Because if I follow you, then at least some of the notions of risk, proliferating risk, pervasive risk, that have been put forward by Giddens, by Norbert Elias, by Mary Douglas, almost defining the contemporary conjuncture, the moment we're at, in terms of a recognition of risk. Well, in a sense, you're adopting a more welcoming approach. You're saying that life involves a much more appropriative, welcoming approach to the invasion or the invasive than these models suggest. So in a sense, the kind of model you're working with is, I think, critical of a great deal of emphasis on risk, because it seems to me that you're talking about cells which are built in such a way as to welcome risk, to need risk, to, as it were, almost incorporate danger in order to learn about it, or to bring danger in order to be able to learn about it, and then manufacture some kind of response to danger. Well, if I follow this more loose, flexible way of looking at the self-other, then in a sense a great deal of the emphasis on risk in economics, sociology, and anthropology needs to be perhaps rethought.
I couldn't agree more. I think that there is an absolute danger in risk and risk aversion. I'm trying to think of common example. I'll give you a common example. In the state of Pennsylvania, I think it was Pennsylvania, perhaps New York. No, I'm pretty sure it was Pennsylvania. When motorcycle helmet laws were implemented to save the lives of motorcyclists, they were challenged by bikers on the grounds that motorcyclists do not, as do automobiles or other larger vehicles, generally cause actually harm, but they are harmed themselves, and that therefore wearing a helmet should be a matter of freedom of choice, not a requirement by law, because motorcyclists are by law should be entitled to a risk and to endanger themselves as long as they're not endangering others. Okay? Now what happened was that they won, the law was repealed, and after the law was repealed, more people rode without helmets than did before the law was implemented.
No, I mean, I think there's a certain...
You see what I'm saying?
Yes. I mean, I think there's a certain tonality to your discourse. There's a certain... which is very much antithetical to what I've just come back from England, is the health and safety society, you know, where at every point we are being asked to be careful, to wash our feet, to bind our feet,
right,
to clothe ourselves, to stuff our nose. Be careful, be afraid, be afraid, be afraid, is the new mantra, and it's all based upon the scientific authorization and the theoretical authorization of risk. We are defining social life in terms of risk. And I think that the tonality of your paper is very much in a different direction, which is welcoming or embracing possible danger.
I'm saying that the outcome of danger is probably more often non-productive than it is productive, which is why we have immunology and why we have illness. So I'm not romanticizing it. But I would say that exactly. I mean, if you go for a walk in a park in England, there's a pond that's that deep, and there's a life vest on a stand. Next to the.
It's coming to most as well.
So this idea that risk aversion is actually in the best interest of people making decisions about who they are socially and morally, I think, is really quite misconstrued. And what interests me about immunology is if you look at this antibody production and you think about antibodies as search engines, and you think about viruses as information, that potentially can be quite dangerous, no doubt, and even lethal at times, but that we need that information.
We need the information seems to be one of the key points
exactly.
You're making in your, is exactly. Underlying, it's the kind of actional or empirical index underneath what you're saying.
Absolutely.
We need the information.
Absolutely.
It's what's coming across. Can I ask? I mean, I'm making you work awfully hard here, and so let me just ask a final question, and then hand over to the audience for a final question or two. And that is, were you saying in outlining new immunological views of the way cells build up? Did you sort of convey the idea that what's going on here is that actually human bodies and all kinds of microscopic bodies actually build up a lot more processes inside themselves and mechanisms than they actually need, that that it's only retrospectively when something a danger attacks them that we begin to see that it's a good thing they did build up this, what I will call very crudely, bank of extra devices, processes, and subbodies. Is that what you were? I mean, I'm putting very crudely a biological process you were outlining, because if that was what you're saying, then it seems to me that bodies, including human bodies, build into themselves all kinds of extras, which may or not be useful. Is that what?
Yes, yeah, I would say, and in fact that not only are they characterized by complex processes which lead theoretical immunologists to actually say that one cannot easily demonstrate an immune system. You can demonstrate a response, but the systemic nature of this is something that is highly contestable.
That's what I got out of what you're saying. In other words, we develop notions of system ex post facto. We develop notions of resistance, of antibody. The very notion of that is an ex post facto idea. What was actually there was a whole lot of stuff, including a lot of, I'm thinking of the well-known word, redundant. That's it. Redundancy is a good thing. Again, I'm looking for a political message here. The political message I see in this is that we are not only living in the risk-averse society, but we're also living in a neoliberal thought regime in which one must be lean and mean. The very definition of efficiency is to cut down on the extraneous, to have just as much stuff as you need from a cost-benefit point of view in order to ward off danger, yeah, to deal with risk, etc., etc. But I'm getting the feeling from the biological processes you are outlining that actually what actual bodies do, or real bodies do, is they build up all kinds of extras and redundancies which only after the fact turn out to be so wonderfully efficient. So in a sense, I think you're also querying our notions of cost-benefit efficiency as well.
I couldn't agree more, and in fact, my last book, The Writing of Passage, is specifically about the problem of assessing what is a catalyst and is not a catalyst for transformation. And one of the clear indicators of the veracity of what you're pointing out, Paul, is the fact that if you actually look at outcomes as they relate to genuine transformation, it's not often that the catalyst for change actually results in a spontaneous transformation. Bring that down to the level of audit culture, and it's not entirely clear that catalysts, that the risks we take, say, by introducing new ideas, have immediate benefit. And in actual fact, they less frequently have an obvious and immediate benefit than they do a long-term benefit. And the long-term benefits take a lot more time to realize, and that redundancy, you know, the common example is the person that says, you know, I really didn't like that. That professor was really, I thought was, you know, I really didn't like the way they evaluated my work. I thought they were far too harsh. And 6 or 7 or 8 years later acknowledges that perhaps, you know, they had it right, but I wasn't in a position myself to acknowledge the merits of that. I didn't need to change or want to change at that time, and I was resistant to that, the risk that was being placed before me, the challenge that was being set before me. And I think more often than not, societies are likely to be more static than they are to change, which is to say that our collective ideas about what is appropriate and right keep us at some level, for good reasons, from necessarily taking on all the risks that are out there. But at the same time, they do limit, and increasingly in an audit context, limit our ability to change or be changed by the outside, because we're prohibited from confronting it.
Thank you very much. Is there a question that's bothering one of you? Something that you really want to push? Well, I think I want to thank you very, very much for a most unusual and new approach to linking up the social body with the biological body. Whatever else you may or may not have demonstrated tonight, for sure I think you've left us with a certain understanding that immunology is good to think with. So thank you very much. Thank you very much, David. Thank you.
You have just listened to a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Non-Self-Help, How Immunology is Reframing the Enlightenment. This talk was delivered by Professor David Napier, Head of the Department of Anthropology and Professor of Medical Anthropology at University College London.